the discussions I enjoyed. In other words, among ham radio operators, we all think that the most ideal ham occupation would be in a broadcast center running zillions of watts out of a very high location, transmitting very appreciated very appreciated material that everybody wants to watch, and you've got something to do with the production of it, or to make sure the RF keeps flowing into that antenna. So you're in that area, and we enjoy probing your brain on this one. I guess it's time we go over to the space report, because a lot of things are going on there.
Touch one more thing, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, John. I know we didn't finish the 415. We're going to go back to that either later or next week. The Hewlett-Packard 415 voltmeter is a very interesting instrument that some of the smart hams have used it. The one catch is that the signal going into it must be the result of a crystal detector that has a 1 KC amplitude modulation. It is a meter that looks for 1 KC of signal, and it ignores everything else. That's part of the reason it has some extreme sensitivity and dynamic range. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, very good. I just want to let you know, it is a 415. He sent me an email. It's a 415 Bravo. I've never seen the Bravo, and it does look like an old 410 or 400 HP meter. Pretty ugly. And has three knobs in the front. And to answer your question, I took a glance at mine, the 415s that I have. They cover 60 dB of attenuation in 10 dB steps. So, and I do use it with my slotted line, and it does work very well. So maybe, if not tonight, maybe later on next week, you can explain how to use it, what it does, and, you know, what it's used for in general terms. That he would appreciate. Okay, back to you, Dick. And that's it from the mailbag, KC2WGB.
Yeah, I'm quite familiar with the Hewlett-Packard 400 in various ABCD versions, and a little bit familiar with the 410. I've used both of those. In my mind, they are very different than the 415. The 400 will look at AC signals from 10 hertz to 10 kilohertz. The 415 will only look at a signal that has an amplitude modulation of 1 kilohertz and nothing else. So they're, in my mind, they're very different instruments. Even though the front panel may have some similarity, there are later versions of the 415 that are kind of attractive. I'll admit that the very early versions do look pretty clunky. We'll get back to that next week and discuss it. Let's go over to Paul's space report, because lots is going on there. And WS2N, here we go. Yeah, it is WS2N. Hey, Paul, what's going on in space? WS2N. And by the way, I found a Neil deGrasse Tyson 1.5 hour lecture on them. He is absolutely positive that we're missing a huge opportunity because we don't simply double the amount of money we give to NASA. His way of describing it is that we give half a penny per dollar goes to NASA. He thinks it should be a full dollar per penny. A full penny per dollar. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, Dick, I'm hoping that Paul has some word on that new plan they were talking about, I believe, Thursday. So maybe he had a chance to read up on that. Back to you, KC2WGB.
So you have time before the end of the segment to go to the subject that I propose.
Yeah, we're discussing the new Earth. Go ahead, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW. The new Goldilocks planet that's like the Earth.
Okay, very good. This is WS2N Space Net Report 159. And of course, we've got a couple of Voyager. Voyager 1 is 132 AU out from the sun, and Voyager 2 is about to click over, probably another month. It's about to click over to 108 AU. So, we just got to cover Voyager, Dick. I was going to talk about the new planet that Kepler has found, but before that, I just want to mention they do have a new picture from Discover. Discover was launched by the Falcon 9 SpaceX. Put that thing up there. at the 1 million mile location away from Earth, in orbit around the Sun, at the L1 position, and it's designed to do two things: either pick up information about the Sun, solar wind, and it'll be able to look at the Sun 24 hours a day, and give us a heads up if there's a solar storm coming. It'll pick up from the ACE spacecraft that's been out there for like 15 years now, and eventually that's going to get tired, but that's still active. But the most important thing is that it's now come online, and it does have a camera to look back at the Earth, so it can take detailed pictures of the Earth from 1 million miles out, which is interesting. You know, we look at pictures that low Earth orbit from the International Space Station, and you see the horizon, and you see how close everything looks, and then you have pictures from geosynchronous orbit, looking down at a hurricane from a GO satellite, and that's out of 23,000 miles. Now you go out to 1 million miles, and you're going to get a complete picture of the Earth. They now release that picture, and they're going to have continuous pictures being sent down, and every couple of days you could go to the Discover website and take a look at what the Earth looks like. It's not just for fun. The climate scientists will use this information to support their theories one way or the other about global warming. But the cool thing is that thing Discover was brought back to life decades ago. It was designed as a Triana, and it was going to be put out there. They mothballed it and they put it into a NASA facility for years on end, and they brought it back to life, and we had a private company called SpaceX put it into that orbit. It took about 4 months to get there, but it's now where finally in operation. So we'll see how Discover does. And if you go to their website, you'll see the name of it is the Deep Space Climate Observatory Satellite, and you could see the science that comes down on that. One other thing before I go to Kepler 452b. I wanted to mention SpaceX. They had an explosion a while back at the end of June, and they believe the results are in. We drop it. Elon Musk, owner of SpaceX, had an interview and believes that a strut, small strut, about 1 inch diameter and they said it was 60 centimeters. It's like 2 feet or something long. One of the many, they have hundreds of struts throughout the first stage and second stage of the Falcon 9 rocket. And they believe that the one inside the oxygen tank, there's another tank inside that tank. And that's a helium tank that pressurizes the oxygen as oxygen is used up inside that tank and blows out the engine. They need another gas to replace that oxygen that's in there, and they use helium, and it's based on a theory that the tank itself would eventually collapse if it wasn't continually pressurized. Called a monocoque system. So this tank apparently got itself loose after the strut broke loose, and mines fraction, suddenly increasing the pressure inside the oxygen tank, and then blowing that oxygen tank that sits at the top. This is in the second stage, by the way. The second stage has this system, the oxygen tank on top, and the fuel tank, the RP-1, was below that. So now they're going to have to work on the problem, and inspect every single strut. That's what he wants to do. Change manufacturers who produce all these struts. Actually, change. engine manufacturer. One website that said it was a steel strut. I'm not too sure about that. I would think maybe it's, you know, aluminum, you know, with lithium in it. I would imagine it's probably welded to the walls of the tank on the inside, and the whole inside of the tank is made out of lithium, mainly aluminum, but a touch of lithium in there for strength. We'll see. I don't know. It could be bolted. I just don't see any diagram of this strut, no matter where I look. So one, but it's not the exact thing. It's what they think it looks like. Okay, and so I just, you know, I had to bring that up. There's plenty of details on that, but rather than stay on that, two other topics, and one is about a $100 million project that they're going to fund to listen to, you know, they want to listen for ET out there. They call it a breakthrough listen. Some Silicon Valley type of investments are going to be funding this thing. The government doesn't fund the projects anymore. So this private money is going to look into a more improved listening system. We've listened for, you know, 50, 60 years. So far, I've heard nothing. And this system, they claim, is going to be 1,000 times more effective than anything that they have now. I don't have much on that, but I just, I know Stephen Hawkins talked about it. Apparently, this funding is coming out of California. But we'll see how that goes. As time goes on, John brought up Kepler 452B. Kepler 452B is an Earth size, a little bit bigger than Earth, but roughly the same size. They've found similar sized planets with Kepler before, but usually a tighter orbit, you know, very tight orbit, you know, maybe as close to Mercury or even less. But this one is about the same distance out as we are from the sun. It's in a system that has a G star, similar to our star, about the same size. And a similar year. We have 365. This thing was at 388 days. Well, at Kepler 452b. We'll hear a little bit more about it in the future, but interesting idea that, you know, this planet could theoretically support life, probably has water, they believe, and they've studied this for some time to make, you know, to confirm that it is a planet. Anytime they come to Kepler, there's now over 1,000 planets that are confirmed, and over 4,000 that are, you know, on the books as possible candidates. Kepler is in its second, it came back to life after it had problems with reaction wheels. Kepler-1 eventually failed, but they now bought this whole telescope that's trailing Earth. It's actually going further away from Earth as days go on, but it's in a solar orbit. And still doing great science. They call it K2 now. Kepler 2.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
What does the time go? In its present configuration, Kepler 2 has already discovered and confirmed 22 new planets. So that's pretty much it outside of the, I wanted to mention three. Astronauts went up to the International Space Station from Kazakhstan last week. A successful flight launched on a Soyuz rocket. One American, one Russian. He's the commander of that mission. And also somebody from the European Space Agency from Japan. I have their names and all in there. They now join the other three astronauts that are on board. And that will bring up the group to six. Where they like it. There's a lot of maintenance on board that has to be done. and yet they want to continue doing science. After all, that's what it was put up for, flying around since 1999, and they want to continue on until 2024. Dick, I'll pass it over to you for any questions. Let me drop it. Before I do, I just want to mention anybody that's interested in Pluto or, you know, astronomy in general, every Tuesday, well, not every Tuesday, but usually I think it was the first and third Tuesday, we have an astronomy net. Craig does an excellent job, KD2CXK, and that comes on at 8:30, and you can always check the website, the Weimar website, in a more accurate time. I always forget. I can never remember which week it was. Dick, over to you, K2RIW, WS2N, for the Space Net Report.
I'd like to hear a couple more words, Paul, on Kepler. Kepler originally had inertial wheels, gyroscopes, call them what you like, which gave very precise aiming of the Kepler telescope. It would allow it to stare at, I forget what the number was, 1,000 stars, or was it, I think it was 100,000 or 150,000 stars. Stare at them for a very long period of time, very precisely, looking for any change in brilliance which represents a orbital planet passing in front of that star, giving you a little bit of dimming that was being measured. When those inertial wheels failed, they found other ways of aiming Kepler, which I think it was by steering vanes that took the solar wind and used that for steering. And I'm wondering if are they getting almost the same amount of aiming precision they had before? Is that allowing them to find these 22 new planets? Let me drop. And Kepler 452b, planet that is Earth-like, a little bit larger, similar sun, but I think it's something like 1,500 light years away. So going there is not easy, but still, as they study its atmosphere and find out what it consists of, it'd be nice to find out, because it's in the Goldilocks zone, it's got liquid water, therefore it's got all the raw ingredients for life. And that name I had trouble thinking of last week was Stanley Miller, the Miller-Urey experiment. The Stanley Miller experiment of something like 1953 is the one where they took inert materials, put it in a flask, passed a spark through it, bubbles a steam through it. You do that for a week, and I think ultimately they found 20 or 23 amino acids in that mixture of that previously inorganic, inert materials. That strongly suggests that life as we know it is spontaneous. You start off with the right raw materials, put it in the right condition, and in theory, life will crawl out of the flask. So with the Stanley Miller experiment, a very pivotal experiment way back in 1953, combined with finding a Goldilocks planet, let me drop it. As long as that Goldilocks planet has got the right amount of water, oxygen, methane, carbon, and so on, we have good reason to believe life will form there every single time. Just wait until it develops, if you know what I mean. So the 452b of Kepler, let me think that. In order to confirm a candidate planet as being real and going around that star, you have to wait until it passes in front of the star either two or three times to make sure you really know the orbital period and that it's not just a glitch in the data. Now with the new Kepler-B mission, where they're doing the aiming of the telescope by other means, we're reasonably they're getting the same aiming accuracy, and therefore they're almost back to the full operation they had when they had the inertial wheels. Give me some words on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW, protect that.
Yeah, K2 is different than Kepler 1. First mission was designed, like you said, over 100,000 stars. It would stare at this one area, I think it was in Cygnus, near the constellation Cygnus. It would stare, for the years, they would just want to leave it in that one spot. And every 10 seconds, they would take a picture with these photometers. No camera on the board. It's almost 3-foot diameter, I'm going to call it, a board with 42 CCDs on board that were staring. and every 10 seconds take a picture. And as time would go by, they would see, you know, every couple of months, you know, one of the stars would just fade out a little bit. Then all this data would come back once a month, and they'd transmit it back to the Deep Space Network. And then they would analyze it, and, after, you know, in the beginning it would be a candidate, and eventually they would confirm it, because they could see with the high accuracy that staring at this one star out of hundreds of thousands, you know, they would pick a star, and they would see it faded a certain amount, and they knew how long it was fading for, you know, each pass of that planet would do the exact same thing, and then, you know, they would confirm it. So that was done like that. Let me drop it. So to do that, you'd have to rotate the spacecraft every now and then. They'd turn up these wheels, these motion wheels, spin them up one way, would turn the spacecraft, turn it, spin them the other way, turn the spacecraft the other way. And that's how they got their, you know, accuracy. You know, springtime, fall, you know, fall, winter, you know, you'd be able to keep it, this thing steady looking behind. It's actually looking behind us as we're going actually forward, be looking back, and it would always be staring at the same part of the sky. I remember seeing diagrams about it. But that's basically how it worked. But K2, since you don't have these wheels to turn the spacecraft anymore, what they do is they, if you look at the Kepler, it doesn't have big solar wings sticking out, you know, similar to a Rosetta spacecraft, you know, with 60-foot wings sticking out. You know, to collect sun, these solar panels are attached to the body, so if you take a big, let's say, can of soda and just put panels wrapping mostly all the way around it, but not quite all the way around. Flat panels, not curved panels. So here's these flat panels. One, I think two, three, four. I think it's four, basically four panels. One side is kind of like open. That's where the where it looks at the stars. That's the aperture. But the four panels, that you have a point where they connect on each one. They point at one point of those panels toward the sun, and that solar wind and photons come off the sun. It would be like trying to balance, you know, a boat with a sharp, you know, sharp bottom. You know, not a round bow, but, you know, two flat points, surface coming together and putting it in the water and just kind of like balancing it there. It's an interesting technique. And now it's been working for some time, and they're going to keep it up. They think it could fly for quite a few more years like this. It does still have some fuel on board, but, you know, to adjust it one way or the other. If it gets out of balance, you might say, it's kind of like balancing it against the solar wind. And that's kind of how they're doing it. So by doing that, now they can't look at the same portion of the sky all the time. It's always looking out away from the sun. Always looking out away from the sun. As you go around the sun, you're going to get a, you know, 360-degree view over the year. So they decided to look at the closer planets, you know, hundreds and maybe a thousand, you know, light years away instead of, you know, all the way out and, you know, far, far away. So they're going to look at the closer planets and closer stars and see what planets are surrounding those stars. It's pretty much what I got on it, Dick, but we'll see how they do. I mean, they're up to 22, and the information is just pouring in every month. Every month they download the information to the Deep Space Network. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the thought I'm having a little trouble understanding, Paul, is that if Kepler is now always looking away from the sun, and it's in orbit around the sun, therefore it's always looking at a different portion of the sky. As such, you can't stare at one portion of the sky for a long enough period of time to watch multiple crossings of a planet in front of a star. So how in the world can it now detect planets? The portion of the sky it's looking at is continuously sweeping in azimuth, so to speak, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, I guess they're using up the whole field of view inside the auto detector, you know. The other way, each one was, you know, each star, 100,000 stars coming through at the same time. Now I guess it revolves around the sun, slowly revolves around the sun, they're switching from one area of the detector to the other, and maybe it's got to be long enough to, you know, pick up some information as the planet goes by, and then as the year goes by, they just come around to that same area and probably look at the same stars. That's why they're not bringing in thousands of planets, you know, I mean, the other way. They brought in over 5,000, almost 5,000 candidates. Here we're up to 22 confirmed, and it's been going like this for, what, a year, probably over a year now, probably a year and a half at least. So, you know, it's going to come back slower. But they're going to be closer planets. And already this one is, what, 1,400 light years out. And, you know, it's not a, you know, I mean, it's far away, but it's relatively close in astronomical terms. That's what I'm thinking, Dick, but I haven't seen exact plans on how they're doing it. Not yet.
Back when the inertial wheels were working, in order to keep the satellite pointed at a precise point in space in the Cygnus galaxy, where the solar wind hitting it is trying to change its orientation. So in order to keep the same orientation, you're winding up these inertial wheels. Eventually, one of the inertial wheels, or maybe multiple ones, get up to maximum RPM. You unwind them by now using a reaction control jet, and now start all over again with the process. And that process of continuously winding up those inertial wheels, I think, is the aggravating factor that caused the ultimate failure. I'd like to believe that had we known earlier that by aiming these panels, these tabs, so to speak, on the spacecraft, that they could have had a little bit more control of the positioning of the satellite by natural means, as opposed to winding up those inertial wheels. Therefore, the inertial wheels, had they started doing this technique sooner, we could have made the inertial wheels last longer. As you can see, I made some guesses on that. But I guess now this current aiming technique only works if the satellite is always aimed away from the sun. Looks like it doesn't have the ability to be the side of it aimed toward the sun, so to speak. And by the way, if it's always aimed away from the sun, that would suggest that the solar panels on the side are being hit by the sun at an edge view, so to speak. I'm having a little trouble seeing what is the real method of operation of K2 as opposed to K1. Back to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, I know I can't describe it over here. I saw a diagram, but it looks like, you know, if you take a can, I use a soda can as an explanation, but, you know, it's not sitting directly parallel to the sun. It's on a tilt, you know, looking away, you know, the top part looking away. And then, but the solar panels, the way they're arranged, you know, it does come down to a point, you know, you put two flat surfaces together, two cards, two aces of spades, and just put them side by side, you know, you're going to have an edge, you know, and that's what they're balancing it off. You know, you take four cards, put it all the way around it, and then you take one of those four cards and you cut a piece off, on a diagonal, and that would be the front of the telescope. You know, you have to look at the pictures, bring up, Bing, and you put in Kepler and, Kepler telescope, and then you click on that, you got a million pictures that come up, you put it under images, and you'll see how the telescope looks. Picture's worth 1,000 words, But again, it revolves around the sun, you know, so it's always looking away from the sun, where the other system, everything was looking back and at one spot, one small spot in the sky. We'll see what happens with the next one, Tesla. I'm waiting for Tesla to go up in about, I think, 2.5 years. That's going to be good. That's going to be a real planet finder.
In the case of the Discovery Falcon SpaceX launch, I think you called it the Deep Space Climate Satellite, it's going to be making lots of measurements of the sun and Earth, I think. ACE used to do something similar, and I think SOHO did something similar. Excuse me. I think SOHO is no longer fully operational. So give me a little bit of the difference of SOHO, ACE, and this new Discovery launch, Eric. I mean, Paul, WS2N, K2IW.
Well, ACE is a NASA project, you know. And SOHO is European, the ESA. But SOHO is, you know, we had a lot of equipment on board, I think, from NASA, you know, from the States, too. It was kind of like a joint mission. ACE was a spacecraft that really concentrated on the solar winds. If they had a coronal mass ejection, you know, this thing would be the early warning system for all our satellites in Earth orbit. And, you know, it's been out there, I think, these are 15 years. But yet, it's still functioning. It might not. They need something else. So, Discover is kind of really picking up where ACE left off. I think SOHO is more of a, you know, it photographs the sun in a lot more different wavelengths and all. And, you know, more information, I think, comes back from SOHO. We'll see. Now, none of them, ACE or SOHO, looks back at the Earth. I mean, this thing has a camera on board that looks back to the Earth. I think that's what's really cool. Looking at climate of the whole Earth at one time. WS2N.
Okay. I think I'm going to take a look at a website that tells me something about what Kepler is doing, because I feel like I'm a little bit behind. But that's a beautiful search for extraterrestrial life. To find habitable planets is certainly the beginning. And this new $100 million contribution for extraterrestrial search, it's about time somebody fund one of those. The fact that it's being privately funded is sort of creating a slight amount of embarrassment. The fact that all of our space agencies have dropped the ball on this one, although I can sort of see why. Let me drop it.
Bulger can be done, Dick.
Oh, you're right, John. It can be done. I mean, there's an organization, I'm having trouble thinking of the name of it right now, of ham radio operators that are doing a deep space search for extraterrestrial intelligence. They're gathering dishes, all aiming them in the same direction, hoping to hear a signal. It's not easy. And so for our government to cease to fund something that has a relatively low probability of success. You put $1 billion into Hubble Space Telescope, boy, you get a beautiful return on your money. And people look at those beautiful pictures and they're happy. Put a similar amount of money, even a fraction of it, into something that's searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. It may take 100 years of search before you hit pay dirt, and therefore you get 99 years of nothing to report to your funding agency. So it becomes a lot more difficult to justify with national government funding, whereas private funding, which doesn't request guaranteed success, that $100 million that was contributed, that person, I don't think he put very many strings on it. You probably have some more words on this one, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, I know they want to use equipment to look at the sky with, you know, laser detectors and all, so then some huge amount of gigabytes per second is supposed to be coming back. They're going to put that out on the internet, whatever comes back, people are going to evaluate it, help them try to determine what they're looking at or what they're listening for. So they're going to link a couple of different radio receivers together, you know, some form of interferometry. $100 million is good money, big money. The government's quit, that was in 1994. Congress, we gave up on receiving and transmitting on, they tried transmission in 1994 at Arecibo. So government money went right out the window. That's it. I don't think a dime is gone for SETI ever since. And I got Paul Allen from Microsoft involved with, I don't know, 100 dishes or something in California. He's got a project going. This one's going to include some kind of construction of a antenna system down in, I think, South Africa someplace. I don't know. I have to read up more on it. Just really letting you know what came out. Actually, this week, they made the announcement. Stephen Hawkins was involved, and he's worried about the aliens coming and eating us or something. Back to you, Dick.
Good comment, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Dick, you said something very important, you know, about experimentation and trying to do research, whether you're looking for something, trying to find a specific. You have to remember Edison's, that little quip that he smashed at the newspapers that time when, well, I know 10,000 things that don't work. So that's part of the adventure, and people have to realize that. Sure, you spent a lot of money in that 10,000 search project, but when you get to the end, that's where it all comes back. So, you know, people, I just think they have to pay attention to that type of logic. Back to you, Dick.
I'm not sure, but I think Edison's original quote was, I know 2,750 things that don't work. Something along those lines, he said. It wasn't as high as 10,000. There aren't that many chemicals he could have tested in the man hours he had, I don't think. Jill Totter, I think is the name of a lady who heads, is at the SETI organization, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and is also a ham radio operator who heads something called the SETI League. But the main Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence's organization in California, I think, is headed by Jill Totter. Do you remember the full name of that organization, Nepal? WS2N, K2LAW?
She's the one that they copied, they kind of copied her life on the movie Contact. I don't think she was involved with the Planetary Society. I thought they used her. You know, I mean, they had Ellie Hathaway was the actual person they used in Contact, but I think they copied it after Jill's life. But what organization they call it, I don't know. There.
We'll eventually find the name. Okay, I thank you, Paul. I think we're going to spend a little bit of time now on this Eiffelberg telescope in Germany. It's 100 meters in diameter. I think there's almost two of them 20 miles apart. This telescope is now starting in 2006, if I understand you, from the information sent to us by Wes. It is doing a search for all the space junk that's out there. They supposedly can resolve things as small as a centimeter, pieces of stuff. And so it is a kind of a bistatic radar. What that means, a bistatic radar is a little bit different than an ordinary radar. An ordinary radar, you transmit a pulse, you flip the system over from transmit mode to the receive mode, and you receive the pulse that comes back. That's a monostatic radar system, one location for transmitting and receiving. A bistatic radar system potentially is a lot more sensitive. You transmit from some point, in this particular case, 20 miles away. I didn't get a clear indication of the size of the transmitting facility, but the receiving facility is this 100-meter dish, 330 feet in diameter, with a super sensitive L-band front end, a cryogenically cooled receiver that achieves something like 8 degrees Kelvin of noise temperature, and it's got liquid helium-cooled sections, liquid nitrogen-cooled sections, and so it's got these seven simultaneous feed horns in a hexagonal pattern. So in other words, the whole dish is looking at six directions at once that are all very closely aligned, and therefore it can see particles that sweep through the field of the dish. And so an exciting looking project. And so Wes found a website that describes this, and he's given us a website to look it up. Hopefully that's on this this website that we all have access to, so that other people can find that website and look at it. Let me pass it over to Wes for some further words on this. N2XJN, K2LIW, the TechNet. Okay, maybe Wes fell asleep, or is not with us right now. You were, I think, received a copy of Wes's also email, and we used to have a website that was named by Bernie, K2YO, in which individual URLs that we're talking about, everyone could go to Bernie's site, which I think was something like huntfamily.org, I think was the name of the site, where you could look at the thing that we're all talking about on the TechNet, and therefore everybody could be on the same page. Correct my memory on this one, John. KC2WGB, back in the dark ages, that's the way we used to do it. Half a year ago, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, you're right. Huntfamily.com, not .org. And I don't believe Wesley mails anything there anymore because it wasn't being used. I did receive that email. I did not read it because it opened up as a question. I looked for the question. I didn't see a question for the mailbag or, you know, for the TechNet. So I did not proceed to read that or go to that website. But it was good information, and it looks like a very expensive project.
Without a doubt, it's an expensive project. I think we should try to arrange for that particular URL, that email address, that website address, to be on the huntfamily.com, if it still exists, so that other people can look at it. It's nicely written, very nicely written, good pictures of how they built this very elaborate feed horn assembly that they're using on one of the world's largest fully steerable radio telescopes, the Eiffelsberg 100 meter, and the only other thing that I know of that's fully steerable that could give it competition is the very large telescope, the Green Bank, what do they call it?
DLA?
No, the GBT, I think it's called. The Great Big Telescope, which now has somebody's proper name for it. The Green Bank Telescope in Green Bank, West Virginia, manned by the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. I was there during the construction of this thing. It's something like 60 million pounds of hardware. It's a 100 meter diameter dish, which consists of 2,600 reflector panels, where each individual panel has a laser interferometer aimed at it, and they've got adjusting motors on the corner of each of the 2,600 panels. As such, that surface can maintain ridiculously high accuracy, such that a dish that size, which normally would be hard to use above 2.5 gigahertz, is usable beyond 100 gigahertz. We go that high in frequency, which means the wavelength becomes that small. Let me drop it. And therefore, you've got 100 meters of diameter. Your gain starts going up to very high numbers. Your beamwidth starts going down to very small numbers. But this is a very precise telescope. Because you can tune the individual panels, now can make a very light structure that continuously self-adjusts itself for temperature differences, wind load, snow load, and whatever. It can maintain its accuracy, as opposed to the approach taken by the Eiffelsberg telescope in Germany. They just built a super strong structure. They maintain surface accuracy by making the structure very, very strong and having a zillion crisscross support bars in that structure behind the reflecting surface. Let me drop them. It's an expensive technique, a heavy technique, but they've made it work very well. So it's an extremely well-respected radio telescope, radar system now in Germany. And so the one thing the article doesn't make clear, it is a bistatic radar system looking for space junk and it became operational, I think, in the year 2006. And this is their website. Gives a very nice description of it. I guess we gotta make sure that Paul gets a copy of that particular website. When he starts reading that one, he'll see some very nicely done, super sensitive hardware. As you make a cryogenically cooled low noise amplifier in the front end of a telescope, as you cool it physically and you use really good electronics, the system becomes more and more sensitive. Let me drop it. Every time you half the number of degrees Kelvin of equivalent noise temperature of your low noise amplifier, the total amount of noise power it's generating was down to half. You pick up 3 dB of sensitivity increase every time you half the noise figure of your system, the overall low noise amplifier, and the rest of the telescope. You make sure you control all those back lobes that are looking at hot Earth, for instance. So as you lower the temperature, it becomes more and more sensitive. You now can listen to weaker and weaker signals. And so comparing room temperature to the 8 degrees Kelvin, I think the number is like 25 dB of increase in sensitivity. You compare 8 to 290 and take that ratio, take the log of it, multiply by 10, you know the decibels of increase in sensitivity. A room temperature 50 ohm resistor, for instance, if you put a really sensitive voltmeter across that resistor, you will measure exactly minus 114 dBm per megahertz. That's the noise power coming out of a 50 ohm resistor, because a room temperature, what your thermometer measures is average kinetic energy of those molecules. That really means how fast are those molecules jiggling around. Oh, each of those molecules jiggling around in position because they're a solid substance. They're not flying around like a fluid. They're moving. They're jiggling in space. Let me drop this. But every one of those molecules that are jiggling in space, they've got a cloud of electrons going around them. So you're moving that electron cloud back and forth with the jiggling of the molecules proportional to what your thermometer measures that we call temperature. Therefore, it's making broadband radio noise, essentially DC to light, broadband radio noise. They call it black body noise. And so any low noise amplifier has to be cooled both electronically and mechanically in order to make it more and more sensitive. And when you're aiming at a cold spot in the sky, I mean, the sky itself, in many places, the temperature of that sky is 3 degrees Kelvin. If you could make your radio telescope aimed at that sky have an equivalent noise temperature of 3 degrees Kelvin, at that instant, half of the noise coming into your telescope is the thing out there in the sky that you're aimed at. The other half of the noise is coming from your old electronics. Your own electronics. So you're already 3 dB down. To achieve 3 degrees Kelvin of equivalent noise temperature of a radio telescope, you and I can set that as a goal. We ain't there yet. See why they try very hard to get there.
Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
We only got about a minute. I'm surprised Wesley fell asleep because apparently it was important. But I have, there was an announcement. LaCroix manufacturers, just to show people how difficult those frequencies you're talking about, they're bringing out a 100 gigahertz oscilloscope. Want to hazard a guess at the price?
Gotta be at least 100,000. Go ahead.
1 million. How about that? That'll be the marketing price. They hope to have it out, I think, in 6 months. They've got most of it designed. But that's how critical that front end of that oscilloscope has to be. So you're really talking about some hairy engineering there.
Okay. Now you and I have got this great big bank account of money that's sitting there getting moldy in my bank account and your bank account. We could pool our resources and buy a thing like that, John. What are we waiting for? You guys have just heard some crazy people that gathered for TechNet number 1,566, if I got the numbers right, yes. And you've heard Space Report number 159. We intend to be back next week and get into more of this craziness. and we'll eventually understand what Mother Nature is trying to tell us. A very clouded message. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, KQRIW, and the end of the technet.
KC2WGB. Yes, as usual, I would like to thank everybody that participated, all those that are listening, and the people on Echolink. Chat room was empty tonight, but good night, good questions, and let's hope we can carry this on again next week about the same time on the same repeater. Wish you all well, and have fun. KC2WGB.
Bye-bye, you all. Later, dudes. And oh, by the way, be kind to each other.
Yes, and remember, it's a hobby, and it's supposed to be enjoyable. So, yes, definitely be kind.
And don't take it so serious. You ain't gonna get out of this one alive.
I ain't gonna leave.
So you're saying, I ain't leaving. I'm staying. Okay. And, good luck with Cookie. I know she's going through a pretty tough period, isn't she, John?
Yes, Dick. It turned out very well. She seems to be back to her normal self, although she's not. So the arthritis is still bothering, but I thought I was going to have to put her down. Thanks for your concern.
Yeah, I had a cat that lived to exactly 21 years of age. But the last year or so, I know she didn't enjoy it. The muscles on her back feet were no longer working, and that makes life pretty difficult. Back to you, John.
Yeah, you know, they deserve quality of life. It's a tough decision to make, but, you know, if you want to be the kind person and deport your dog, you got to do it. Oof, tough to do. But, yeah, I know what you went through.
Yeah, my family members were really attached to that animal, and we went into crying periods for at least 3 or 4 months afterwards. Bye-bye, John. K2RIW clear.
Good night, Dick. Good night, Paul, and everyone. See you next week. Talk to you next week. KC2WGB clear. DD2CBB. D2WGB.
You have an outside antenna connected to TV set there, John?
I have an antenna, but I haven't used it because I don't watch much TV. But I do have one.
Is it an outside antenna?
Yeah, it's a Channel Master Yagi style. And, yeah, it's outside mounted, but I don't have a rotor on it.
That's too bad. You can have a lot of fun DXing. The band's been open from about the Virginia, North Carolina border all the way up to Massachusetts area. Getting loads of stations coming in. Some I've got four, and I got a new one tonight from Boston.
New ones are always good. I used to get a thrill out of those. Yeah, I haven't done much DXing. You know, when you're looking for stations and trying to determine, you know, how many watts they run and where are they located and all that, and logging it all up, that's something to do. But as far as programming, I'll tell you, most of the programming on TV to watch as interest sucks.
I only watch a small handful of channels locally. I try to watch PBS stations. I enjoy some of the programming on those, but those are getting a little hard to copy sometimes with the band conditions in the past couple of days. It kind of hammers stuff up and down, but, you know, that's how it is sometimes. But I enjoy the other aspect of it, just dealing with DX and the new TV station that I haven't got before.
Yeah, you know, if you get a chance, which I was surprised, I was talking to Eric about, I like the Nova programs and those things that are on Channel 13 and 21. If you talk to him about the length of time it takes to produce those and to put them together and what they cost, you would be amazed.
No, I can actually imagine that. I can imagine how much it actually does cost. It's a lot of money, probably more than a regular program. But, you know, that's the way things happen sometimes.
Yeah, a lot of effort is put into the time out in the field. You know, never mind the studio work and all that, but just that waiting there for those photographs, filming and all that, the incredible amount of time. So, yeah, it's like anything else that's worthwhile. Big efforts go into it. So I do appreciate that.
No WHYY. Well, I was watching a program from one of the channels in Connecticut earlier this morning on about the MH370 plane that went down over a year and a quarter ago, and they said they tracked the thing basically from satellite signals from it, and from the signature of the satellite signals that gave me a very good idea where the direction of the plane, where they should look for it. I thought that was quite an interesting topic they were getting into.
Yeah, they've had that information for a while, and I know some of the serious people were tracking that by that information, but there was so much leading crap of where it was going, where it could have gone, and they were all distracted. But, you know, it's a long time, and they haven't found any information at all. So I'm sure if they search the plot that's determined by the satellite information, that's where it's going to be. I concur with that.
In fact, to add part of the program, they said they have a trial system running on some aircraft right now where they can completely communicate through satellite systems globally and pretty much figure out where the plane is at any particular instant in time, because many, many places through radar, they lose the plane after like 250 miles out. VHF, and even it's even hard to talk on HF sometimes, so this kind of system would give them like a pinpoint of where the plane is pretty much any time they want to know. No, I'm still keying it up, right? You can probably talk to me. I'm coming into the IRLT anyway, so it doesn't really matter to me. Yeah, I was observing some of the signals on my service monitors on the lower TV channel. In fact, one channel, I know we don't get that terribly strong, and we'll get it quite viewable for quite a length of time even right now. The signal level coming in was this station's in Atlantic City, about minus 25 dBm on the pilot carrier. That's the strongest one I've ever seen come in my outside antenna. For me, over the water, it's probably more than that, because I'm 50-something miles out from New York City.
Disconnected.
Yeah, okay. I hear the more on the input with the repeater with the plane with the digital radio signal, you know, like that's going to interfere with everything. Anyway, yeah, it's a very good band opening tonight, so it's I was listening to the tech net in the background and then from the other room, and I was just swinging the antenna back and forth trying to, you know, catch a few stations, see if I could get any new ones, but it's very, very nice signal enhancement like this. But it's just one of those type of things with these aircraft. They get lost like this. I guess it's not the first time. The one that crashed over the off the coast of South America a couple of years ago, the Air France plane, took them quite a while to find out, but that was a much smaller target area they had suspected, because that one reported the GPS coordinates. But even then, it still took them quite a while to actually pinpoint all the parts of the wreckage. So this one that went down, you know, like a little over a year ago, who knows what that thing ended up. Yeah, it's understandable. It's just, you know, I guess one of those things. I just stick with mostly some of the major networks coming out of the city for watching news and so forth, and flipping around here and there to watch other various stuff. That's about it. But I know people are going to have different opinions on this stuff, too. You know, so we can go out to really out left field or right field.
I do all to connect off.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
I delaw to connect off.
Newsline report number 1969 with a release date of Friday, July 24th, 2015. The following 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QFC. Your ARRL membership dues are going up. Amateur Radio Newsline's Young Ham of the Year scores another big win. AMSAT gets a chance at a rideshare into orbit. Hutters competes to be champ in a hidden transmitter hunt. And Mexican amateurs get a new global repeater directory. All this and more in Amateur Radio Newsline report number 1969 coming your...
Connect enabled.
Warning, the time is 12:29 a.m.